Board services. We do these occasionally seminars on issues relevant to the whole community. They're called Community Awareness Programs or CAP. And today is a special Community Awareness Program. It is a full-length one. I'm going to be speaking to you for about 45 minutes. And the topic is supporting a family member with a mental health illness. So the agenda for today is, first we will talk a little bit about what is mental illness. We'll talk a little bit about the stigma of mental illness in our communities, some causes for understanding why mental illness hits some people. And then we would like to spend a bit of time on how families can cope. Firstly, by recognizing a problem. Secondly, by getting help. And also, we're going to be dealing with what if the person refuses to get help, the person who is suffering from mental illness, what if they refuse to get help? And then we will talk a little bit about what recovery looks like and what the process of recovery is. So it is a fully packed agenda. And in case we don't go through everything, just to let you know, the slides are extremely detailed. And the reason for that is that the slides will be available on our website, which is linked through to the main website for jafri.org. So the presentation and the slides will be available for whoever needs it afterwards. So let's first start by talking about what is mental illness. Mental illness can be understood in two ways. First of all, what is mental health? Right? Mental health is a state of well-being in which the individual realizes their own capabilities, they can cope with the normal stressors of life, they can work productively and fruitfully, and is able to make a contribution to their community. So basically what this means is that although they may have stressors in their life, the stressors are not impacting the way they live their life. This is a very important point to know. Mental illness, on the other hand, is a recognized, medically diagnosed illness that results in a significant impairment of an individual's either thinking, feeling, or the way they relate to human beings. So the biggest, I would say, the marker for mental illness is that it is impacting their life to the extent that they cannot live, quote-unquote, a normal life. And mental disorders can include problems with how a person thinks. So that an example would be schizophrenia. It could be a problem in how a person feels, example depression or anxiety. Or it can also involve potentially harmful behavior. So for example, eating or substance abuse disorders, all of them can be included in the concept of mental illness. Now, it's important to realize that mental illness and mental well-being is not a static state. So it is on a continuum. In other words, many of us can have some symptoms, can have some signs of not being well mentally, and still we would not be diagnosed. In other words, even if you have a diagnosed mental disorder, it doesn't mean that each and every moment of your life you are suffering from that. So it is important to realize that you can have a good level of mental health even with a mentally diagnosed, with a diagnosed mental disorder. This is an extremely important thing to recognize, because often what happens is that when you first get the diagnosis, it can be a very, very, you can get panic thinking that this is what you have to live with day in and day out. But as we will see in a bit, that is not necessarily so. Now, who is impacted by mental illness? So how common is it? You know, there's various stats available, but the general agreement is that about 20% of the population at any time in Canada suffers from a variety of mental disorders. This proportion is actually quite high amongst adolescents. Adolescence seems to be the time when mental illness hits the first time. And many people would say that, you know, if you can get to the age in your mid-20s and if you've been mentally well up to then you are much less likely to succumb to any of this. And as we know, the most commonly diagnosed mental illnesses are depression and anxiety. So the idea is that it can actually strike any single person. I think this quote is really valuable. It says that there are really only 8 kinds of people affected by mental disorder. It is a very small list, but we all know someone on it. Someone's mother, daughter, sister, or wife. Someone's father, brother, husband, or son. In other words, people just like us. People like you. Now, one of the most common questions we get when we're talking about mental illness is this. But we are Muslims. And somehow we believe that the fact that we are Muslims inoculates us, it prevents us from having mental disorders. And the reason to stress this, that this is really not so, is because this is a very damaging belief to have. What it does is it really distances people who have it. It creates a whole environment of secrecy, of shame, and what it does is it actually really prevents people from getting help. So, do I have the stats for how common mental illness is in the Muslim population? No, I don't. But here's the thing. First of all, yes, we do have some protective factors. So as we see, faith and spirituality can be a protective factor, and it can promote mental wellness. On the other hand, in our community, we have a lot of stressors. The stressor of immigration, for example, there's a lot of cultural stressors which actually make it a more risk factor that we may suffer from that. Abuse and trauma is a huge significant risk factor for mental illness, as we will see in a moment. Now, the thing is that when we don't recognize that this can impact Muslims, and it actually does not mean that you lack faith or that you're a bad Muslim, what happens is that there is an experience of stigma. Stigma is basically that the person who's suffering goes through a sense of disgrace or discredit, and it sets a person apart from the others. What is the experience of stigma like? There is shame that you are feeling these things. There's a lot of blame involved. There's blaming of self. You know, when a child is being diagnosed with a mental illness, a lot of parents will feel a sense of blame towards themselves. And we really need to, instead of encouraging that blame, which we sometimes do as a community, we really need to support them and to understand that this can actually happen to any of us. It doesn't mean that they're bad parents. The stigma also leads to a lot of secrecy. People don't want to talk about it. And what happens that even though we have really good facilities, we live in North America, we're lucky to have support. What research has shown and what people in the mainstream always say, that although the incidence of mental illness may be the same in the Muslim community, they're much less likely to seek support. And when you don't seek support, obviously the journey is much harder than it needs to be. With the right help, people can live a very fulfilling and contributing life to society. There's the experience of being the black sheep of the family. So the person who is experiencing, has so-called a double whammy, right? Not only are they experiencing all of these things, but they feel that they have somehow failed their families. This leads to isolation and social exclusion. So a lot of times, when a family member is going through that, we are ashamed of them and we do not encourage them to become members of the society. We somehow, want them to stay at home and not be seen in public. And this obviously results in stereotypes and in discrimination. So what are the causes of mental illness and why is it happening? Obviously, there are a lot of theories and none of them have been proven. But some of the theories are that it is a combination of biological and environmental factors. What does this mean? So just like physical health, for example, if you are prone to diabetes, you may have genetic predisposition, it may be in your family, but it does not mean that you will necessarily get it. There are environmental factors, so the kind of lifestyle you lead, the kind of support you have, whether or not you exercise, whether or not. So all of these will be balancing factors. Similarly with mental illness, there is the role of genetics. So people who have mental illness in their families are much more susceptible to it. There is the environmental factors. What are some of the environmental factors? The two biggest ones are abuse and trauma. So if a person has been abused or traumatized in their youth, it is far more likely that they will end up with a mental illness. And I'm going to read a little bit of a story for you of a person who has shared her own experience. And the link to her story is there. It will also be posted with the slides. I'm, you know, just a bit of disclosure. It is an extremely difficult story to hear. I will not read the whole thing. I am going to censor it a little bit. But, you know, read it, listen to it with some empathy for somebody who is going through this. So it is called A South Asian, East African, Middle Eastern Perspective on Mental Illness, Abuse, and Family. With culture comes thousands of unwritten rules and regulations that other cultures are bound to be confused by. I have seen all kinds of cultures and customs. I have been to nightclubs. I can say my prayers in Arabic and in English. I speak three languages. I have stayed in group homes and women's crisis centers and have stayed at a shelter in one of the seediest areas of Vancouver's downtown core. I have taken drugs and wake-up pills to relieve my pain and to study for exams at university. I have had a Muslim friend commit suicide because she was not accepted by her community, and I have many times almost been that Muslim girl. Many articles about mental illness are written from the outsider's perspective looking in. I would like to go beyond the scientific and clinical perspectives made by the medical health professions and offer a chance to explore the clashing, contradictory cultural expectations of one East African-born, Indo-Canadian, mentally ill Muslim woman. Welcome to my mind. It is a bit crowded in here, but you'll get used to it. I was diagnosed with bipolar disorder 7 years ago at the University of British Columbia's Mood Disorder Clinic. In the same year, this very same university awarded me my Master of Fine Arts degree with high honors. Interesting? I think so. Here, on one hand, I was being commended for my skills in English, writing, and the creative arts, while just blocks away on the other side of campus, I was being diagnosed as mentally ill, technically insane. Now, you may never truly understand what it was like for me, but I can tell you that after those 9 years of diligently educating myself with my peers, and honing my skills to hopefully one day be an inspiration and dedicated professor of the creative arts, I never imagined that one day I would be sitting here inside my house for days, sometimes even for weeks, riddled with anxiety and pain and fear and anger. I was sure I knew where I was going in life, but in 1997, my life started going on without me. I had been locked up by my family 36 times over the last 7 years for being different. Or shall I say, for not being quite what they wanted me to be. I was a westernized Indian girl. I had never before revealed my story to anyone. But today, for my Muslim, Hindu, and Sikh sisters everywhere, the time is now. Someone has to say something, and I'm not going to wait for the someone. And then she goes on to tell about her abuse in her own family. And then she says, let's start with some of the most serious misconceptions about mental illness in the South Asian community. Mental illness is not caused by spirits possessing your body or by the nazar, the evil eye from jealous relatives or friends. It is not curable by holy water or special prayers. And mental illness is most definitely not the punishment for ill deeds of a past life. Then she talks about her illness, her abuse, and says, although the family knows about it, to this day nothing has been done. I never spoke of the first abuse till 6 years later at age 15, and instead of being protected and consoled, I was severely beaten in front of my mother, brother, and cousin for making up such a story. No one helped. I then learned to keep things to myself. Many years later, it was discovered that I was, in fact, abused. By this time, it was too late, and so much easier to lock me up every time I tried to speak about it. It was so much easier to discredit me in order to protect the name of the family. I was branded pagal and most likely unfit for marriage. This is another common response made by Indian culture. Quick, find a husband for her or you will be stuck with her. Nonetheless, I did my own searching, and after many betrayals, I was always left in the same place with a family and community that have chosen to disrespect and discredit me rather than coming to terms with the severe damage my upbringing might have caused me. Then she talks about how she saw a Muslim psychiatrist who also did the same thing, who refused to believe her. And, you know, finally she was able to find a psychiatrist in the mainstream who helped her. In the meantime, I take life day by day, and I found an excellent psychiatrist who knows of other cases like mine and who has found the perfect chemical cocktail to help stabilize me and ease the pain of all that I have been through. I take the medication and I do my part. But most importantly, I live my truth. I offer my story to other South Asian women like me who are in similar circumstances. Reach out and don't be scared. You will find the help you need. People can be cruel. They will come to the hospital when you break your leg, but no one comes to the hospital with flowers or cards when your mind is broken. Mental illness is not contagious and stigma kills. Please speak up or help someone you know and do something about it. We have to come together. So that is her story. And the reason why I shared this is a few reasons. First of all, to recognize what staying silent in the face of trauma and abuse can do to a life. Secondly, to recognize that the sooner we seek help, the easier life is. It seems really difficult when we first have the diagnosis, and yet we can start the road to recovery as soon as we accept it. So can we protect ourselves from mental illness is another very common question we get. And I'm not sure we can protect ourselves from mental illness, because just like heart attacks and diabetes, you can live a good life, you can live a pure, clean life, exercise, and you may still be struck. And the same is with mental illness. However, there are some things that we can do to maintain our mental well-being. And these are called seeds of mental wellness. And I'm just going to go through them, and I invite you to look them up more later in your own time. So S is for sunshine and spirituality. We know that sun and vitamin D is a very important part in keeping us mentally healthy. Exercise is a huge promoter of mental health. Environment, again, having close relationships, having emotional support, being able to speak up, not being shut down every time you open your mouth. Diet, you know, what you eat, just a clean life, and sleep. All of these things promote mental wellness. So how do we cope with mental illness in the family? The first step is to recognize that there is a problem. The second is to deal with our own emotions. When somebody in the family is dealing with a mental illness, it does impact the whole family. And it's okay to feel a variety of emotions. It's a really good idea to get help for yourself as well, because you were wounded. And then we'll talk a little bit about getting help and what if the person refuses. So recognizing mental illness in children. And you know, these are again just signs. Even if somebody has all the signs, it doesn't mean that they have it. And if somebody has none of the signs that you can recognize, it still may mean that they have it. The idea is not to self-diagnose, please. You know, often when people come to counselors, they expect us to diagnose mental illness, and we are not qualified to do so. Only medical doctors or psychologists can tell you for sure, and they do that by a variety of tests and sometimes blood tests. So recognizing it in children, reluctance to separate from parents, a significant decline in school performance, frequent aggression, worry, anxiety, sleep problems, persistent disobedience, withdrawal from activities, refusal to go to school, anything which causes a significant change in their behavior should be looked at. So if your child suddenly changes behavior, it is a good idea to just check it out. And the first step with children should always be either their school counselor or the family doctor. In teens, again, it's something to know that mental illness is highest in teens. In adolescents, it is extremely high. And again, you know, this is the time when many of us are separating from our children. In other words, we're not so involved in their lives. So it's a good idea to keep an eye on what's happening in your teen's life. Substance abuse, inability to cope with problems in daily activities, change in sleep or eating habits, excessive complaints of physical ailments, acting out, intense fear of weight gain. This is again a very, it's an environmental thing, but it's extremely common these days. You know, young people will often hurt themselves. The self-harming is very common as well. So if you notice that your teen, even at home, is, you know, always trying to cover their arms, or they're acting secretively, it is a good idea to check it out. Frequent talks about suicide or thoughts of death, and again refusing to go to school. Recognizing mental illness in adults. Again, a significant change or decline in work performance, not wanting to go to work, prolonged depression, feelings of extreme highs and lows, excessive anxiety or worries, social withdrawal, dramatic changes in eating or sleeping, and deterioration of work in school or on the job. So again, anything which is significantly different, it could actually have a physical cause as well. So it is always a good idea to have it checked out by a doctor. Strong feelings of anger. And you know, sometimes when we're living with somebody who is continuously angry, we think that that's wrong. You know, we just get used to walking on eggshells around them. And it could very well be, especially in men, depression, or, you know, very often shows up as anger. So a person who is regularly angry or not able to manage their temper, it is something that, you know, we need to be concerned about. Delusions or paranoia. So, you know, imagining things, imagining that everyone is against them, taking extreme precautions to hide things from other people, suicidal thoughts, again, the lots of physical ailments which have no physical basis, and again, substance use. Substance use, by the way, you know, we often think that it is a lack of faith and it is going down the wrong path, and that may be so, but from, you know, substance use in people with mental illness, in the general population, it's about 13% of people who are abusing substances. In people who are who have a mental disorder, the figure goes up to 50%. So one in two people with a mental illness is likely to be abusing substances. So now, what happens when you first hear of, when you first recognize that there is something going on? For the person who has been diagnosed, it can often be a huge relief. You know, very often young people will say that, I wish somebody would tell me what's going on in my head. Because when you are going through something which you do not understand, it's actually a relief to have a label. And a label does many things as in the community. This is important to know. So here's the thing, if you think that a label is, you know, you don't want to be labeled, that's fine, because at the end of the day, the whole DSM, you know, the category of mental illnesses, it is made up by human beings, right? It's not an exact science. But what a label can do is actually give you access to a lot of resources.
So say, for example, somebody's been diagnosed with schizophrenia, right? Suddenly you have access to support groups, to people coping with it, and you can actually learn how to manage your illness a lot better. So a label can be extremely helpful for some people. For the family, it can often be extremely hard to understand. And it is common for the family to go through a whole roller coaster of emotions. So if you are going through, you know, denial, anger, shame and embarrassment, secrecy, blaming yourself and others, these are all completely normal parts of the reaction. When you first hear about it, it's almost like somebody has pulled the rug from under your feet. And it is a huge thing to accept. But the sooner you can get help for yourself as well, the sooner you can start on the road to recovery for yourself and for others. The diagnosis of mental illness can bring about a lot of grief and loss. The idea that life can never be the same again and all that you hoped for that person may never come true. But it is important to realize that many people with mental illness live extremely productive and fulfilled lives. It does not have to be that way. So getting help. What to do if you suspect a problem? First of all, if it is a situation where you're suspecting that the person is a danger to themselves or another, you have to call 911. You have to make sure that the people in the home are safe and the person themselves are safe. You know, very often when a family is living with somebody who has a mental illness, the refusal of the family to get help is putting other members of the family at risk and danger. And it is not fair on the, you know, say for example, if you have other children, you know, they are living a life of great anxiety, not knowing what the person is going to do. So as soon as they get help and they can get on the road to recovery, and the family is educated about how to handle the thing, it becomes much easier for the whole family. You can let the person know that you have noticed changes in their feelings and behavior and that you understand that they're having difficulties. You can listen and try to solve the problem together. It does not work to tell the person who has a mental illness to just look on the bright side. You know, just be grateful. If you had faith, have tawakkul in Allah. All of these things are true and they're not enough. The person could have a lot of faith, they could have a lot of patience, and they could have all of these things, and yet there's a chemical imbalance in their brain which is not helping them think through things properly. So it's a really good idea to allow the person to stay in control as much as possible and offer to help them to find out more how to get assistance. It's also a good idea, this is for the whole family, to stay positive about the future because things will improve as soon as they get help. So how can the family help? Obviously by seeking help from a doctor for a checkup. Advocacy. Advocacy means that you speak up for them when they're not able to. Make sure that they are getting all the accommodation that they're allowed. You can help with medications, appointments and treatments. You can support a healthy lifestyle for the whole family, and you can provide emotional support. However, you have to know your limits. It's, you know, the most difficult thing for the family is probably recognizing that they cannot fix this. That is probably the most challenging thing. You can only encourage, but you cannot actually do anything for anyone else. And again, we have to remind ourselves not to keep telling them to just get over it. You know, the equivalent is if somebody had a broken leg, you wouldn't tell them, you know, it's all in your mind, just why are you not running? For a person who's having issues thinking clearly or managing their temper or anything like that, that's exactly what it is. We're telling them to do something which they're actually not capable of doing. Now we come to probably the most difficult part, which is when they are too ill to see. The nature of mental illness is that a lot of times a person who is mentally unwell is not recognizing, is not capable of knowing that they are not functioning properly. And there are, again, you know, the options are that you learn to live with it and you do what you can. You know, this is a long-term strategy, right? But when it comes to the, you know, especially with things like schizophrenia, when they're having active hallucinations, when they're having an active psychotic episode, when they're violent, when they are really destructive in the home, that is the time when you really need to make a decision what to do. And I'm not going to go through this, but I'm just going to explain a little bit what it means by involuntary admission. You know, one of the questions that comes up very often for families dealing with this, and which is probably the hardest thing to explain, is how can I get them help? You know, often people will call counselors and say, you know, see so and so. But as you probably know, that in this country, we cannot see somebody who is not willing to be seen. You cannot make an appointment for an adult who does not want to seek help. So what are your options? Your options are actually to do what we say, form them, F-O-R-M. And what this means is there's three different types of form. There's form one, form two, and form three. And what it is simply a different level of intervention from the hospital. So essentially what it means is that you will call 911 and they will come and they will take the family member to hospital against their will. This is not an easy thing for anyone to experience. And if you do have to experience, I strongly suggest that you get help for yourself. You also need to remind yourself, because it's very difficult to see a family member being treated like that. And what you need to do is you really need to remind yourself that you are doing it out of love. The reason why you're doing it is because this is the only way to get help. I personally will know many people who have been formed, like who were taken to hospital against their will, who are now way on their way to recovery, are completely symptom-free, are living extremely productive, successful lives. But it took that courage from someone to actually admit them into hospital against their will. So please know that if you have to do this, please have the courage to do it. Because without that, it would be a long time when they're not getting any access to any kind of medication or any other kind of support. So the road to recovery, what does that look like? A person with mental illness can recover even though the illness is not quote-unquote cured. So for example, you can have diabetes but not the symptoms of diabetes, right? You can have heart disease but you cannot have all the symptoms of heart disease. Similarly with mental illness, even if you've been diagnosed with schizophrenia, for example, and you are under the doctor's care and on medication, you can live a very long time without any symptoms at all. And also to know that if you have a setback, you know, if you fall back and you get active symptoms again, it doesn't mean it's the end of the world. What it means is that recovery in anything, whether it's substance abuse, whether it is mental illness, it's not a straight line. It goes up and down. So even if you have a setback, you can get back on track. What are some of the positive factors that promote recovery? So a strong social support network and emotional support. This is where the community really comes in. So if we can change our attitudes towards mental illness as a community and reach out to people and encourage them to be involved and inclusive rather than shutting them out, that can greatly help in recovery. Stable living conditions and a structured environment. So mental illness, as we know, puts people at risk for poverty. How? Because sometimes families throw them out, and that's the honest truth. And the more we can keep them within our own homes and provide that stable environment, it can really help with recovery. A sense of purpose, of contribution to society. A good understanding of what has happened. So again, what getting medical attention does is that they understand that, you know, they're not to blame, that this is something that is actually, you know, there's an imbalance in their brain. And once they learn how to manage to deal with it, it can get a lot better. Lastly, I'd like to invite us to keep hope alive. even if you are experiencing that, you know, as Muslims, the amazing thing is that our faith really helps guide us. We know that when we are undergoing trials, they are not pointless trials. When we go through the trials and come out stronger the other end, and when we continue to maintain our connection to Allah in the middle of the trial, that is what looks like, finding meaning among suffering. Expanding your focus, what does that mean? So when a family is going through something like this, it is very easy to only focus on this one issue in your life. And what success looks like for families is to recognize that yes, they have somebody with a mental illness in the family, and that they have a lot of other positive things in their family. So it is simply a matter of, and that by the way goes with any issue or trouble that we have. When things start going wrong, we begin to narrow our focus and we only begin to focus on the one thing. And mental well-being looks like you have a problem and you expand your awareness to include not only the problem but also all the positive things around you. We need to take care of ourselves. So when we are caregiving for somebody, either with a physical or mental illness, it is very draining. And if you can find support, if you can find respite, if you can find somebody to take over and look after yourself, because this is a long haul. It's not something that is going to go away very soon. So it is a good idea to keep up our own resilience. And what's the role of the community? To destigmatize, to understand that this can happen to anyone, that it is within our communities, and what the stigma has done is it has shut out those people that most need help. So if we reach out to a family that we know is suffering, it can greatly enable them to be on the road to recovery. We need to empathize rather than blame. We need to remind ourselves that it can happen to any of us. And we need to support without needing to know the whole story. So many families who are going through this could really use some support. And what stops them from reaching out for support is the idea that they are going to have to disclose their entire life story. So really, if we can just be there for someone on their terms, however they want to deal with it is fine. This is how we can be, all of us can reach out and be support to others within the community. So what are some of the resources? As many of you know, we have Jamfree Support Services within our community. It is a free service for members. Currently we have two psychologists on staff who are able to provide psychotherapy, not only for people with mental illnesses, but also for their families. The Center for Addiction and Mental Health is a large hospital which deals with these issues. They have a lot of resources, and a lot of research is being done there as well. There's the Canadian Mental Health Association, which has branches all over Canada. It has services not only for the people, but again for family, like support groups and things, and it all depends on which office. So I've given the address here for Markham and Warren, but they also have offices in Aurora, Newmarket. This is a family toolkit. It is an excellent resource. It's about 130 pages, and it actually gives the family a blueprint to deal with the illness from beginning to end. It's an excellent resource, and again, we will put a link on our website. And here are some additional resources. So thank you very much for your attention, and inshallah, we can deal with this, all of us together. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.